The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello and joining you from the Tramuntana Mountains in Mallorca this week. My name is Daniel Freeba. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast in a week when a much-loved football highlight show in the UK was silenced because of something its host said on Twitter, evoking memories of a journalist strike and hence eerily voiceless 1994 Milan-San Remo for Italian TV viewers. So if you're nonplussed at having to sit through nearly 7 hours of what some heathens call the most boring race on the calendar on Saturday, imagine having no commentator along for the ride or inevitable pogcineration. We'll also be talking about Paris-Nice, where I was last week, and we'll be serving up hot takes from Tirreno Adriatico. When I say we, taking his place in this week's trifecta is a man who, if he squints or possibly invests in a very powerful telescope, can look out across the Med and practically see the Poggio di San Remo from his bedroom window in Pietrasanta. Somewhat surprisingly, no Dane has ever won La Classicissima, but today we're expecting some triumphant input into our race preview from a gentleman who knows his capo mele from his Berta and proved his Ligurian credentials with us on the Giro last year by dunking a large square of salty, oily focaccia into his cappuccino. It's former CSC Green Edge and Sky press chief and Leopard Trek team manager Brian Nygaard. Nygaard, I've given you the proper Danish, kind of proper Danish pronunciation this week. Brian, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I got back from California a few weeks ago, and it feels like I've turned back to, came back to Italy, and it's spring, and all the important races are full on. So we're in probably, if you look at, not look directly at the Giro, my favorite part of the year.
Brian, do you know your capo mele from your capo berta? Can you tell us, what are the order of the capi?
That's a tough one, is it? Yeah, that's actually a tough one. But I actually think it's in the, you gave it away by saying in the right order when you asked the questions.
It depends which way you're traveling.
Well, I would suggest the race route, obviously.
Depends which way you're traveling, as our third guest reveals his identity. Well, come on, give us the order. The three.
Capo mele, capo berta.
He's got it. Okay. I was hoping to score some early points there, but no. Also joining us this week is a man who is on the way to Milan-San Remo as we speak and has even announced that he'll be wrecking the Cipressa and Poggio for us on Friday afternoon, which should just about give him enough time to avoid getting tarmacked by Pogacar on Saturday afternoon. He requires no further introduction. And last week required no further host, summarily dispensing with my services. He is, this week at least, Il Leone della Riviera Ponente, Lionel Burney.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Thank you, Daniel. Yes, I'm on the way to San Remo. We're not going to cut out the Capi either. We're going to do them as well as the Cipressa and the Poggio. Simon Gill, Simon the photographer, and I are traveling down. I am speaking to you from a hotel bedroom in Mâcon. So we're roughly halfway. It's not actually an Ibis, no.
I stayed in Ibis last week. I'm going to shame Ibis on this week's podcast. We were absolutely ripped off by Ibis in Orléans. Terrible Ibis in Orléans for €120 a night. Disgraceful. Anyway, go on.
Well, I mean, if Ibis's lawyers are listening, their pricing is presumably fair and competitive. I don't know. I must admit, I do think the cost of travelling here in Europe has taken a bit of a hike, it feels, compared to even last year, which felt expensive. But we are in a central Mâcon location. As soon as I finish recording the podcast, Simon and I will head down to San Remo. I'm there to make a Friends of the Podcast special, which Tom Wally will be putting together for us to go out next week. And of course, Daniel, we will be speaking on Saturday evening while Pogacar and co are still dampening down or drying off the sweat from their brows. We will be recording an episode of Arrivé, the first of the classic season, won't we? And that will go out on Saturday night. Our snap look at how Milan-San Remo shakes down.
How is Mâcon looking, Lionel? It's a lovely spot there on the Saône, but I've been ripped off a few times in Mâcon, some very expensive restaurants on the Saône.
It's actually great value I think it's one of the best values.
Here we go.
If you
Here
want a Burgundy type Chardonnay, Mâcon is really the place to go.
A mere £1,000 a bottle. Yeah.
No. It's a warmer area and they're riper earlier, so they're actually quite drinkable at an early age. Get in there, Lionel. There's some great bottles for you waiting just down the road.
Well, we're driving today, Brian, so I won't have my usual breakfast wine. it's just a relief. It's just a relief to see the sunshine. I mean, it's glorious and bright out. It's quite crisp and cold, but the UK has been in the depth of winter, it's felt like, the last few weeks. And so it's just lovely.
Years.
It's just lovely to see the sunshine.
Shall we press on, chaps, with the news roundup? News roundup in which this week we're gonna prioritize quality over quantity. A few relatively big stories, talking points we're gonna reflect on in some depth. Start with, well, where I was on Monday. There was a press conference in Nice on Monday with the tour director Christian Prudhomme revealing details of what will be the closing weekend of the 2024 Tour de France. We already knew that the race would finish in Nice. We learned on Monday that the penultimate stage will be a mountain blockbuster with ascents of the Col de Brousse, Col de Turini and the Col la Colmiane, followed by a reprisal of the 15.7-kilometer Col la Couillole, which hosted a summit finish at Paris-Nice at the weekend on Saturday. On the last day in 2024, we'll then see a very hilly, I would actually say 35-kilometer mountain time trial starting in Monaco and finishing on the Promenade des Anglais in Nice. Chaps, first thoughts. I mean, I think we discussed a few weeks ago, can't remember who we had on the pod that week, but I'm very excited about the tour finishing somewhere other than Paris. And well, it's quite an iconic location in itself in cycling, largely due to Paris-Nice, isn't it? The Promenade des Anglais. And what a cracking final weekend we're going to have, because the Col la Couillole, I mean, I was there on Saturday, and that's so the southern part of the, what they call the Mercantour Alps, and one of the more remote and more beautiful, more sort of savage, sauvage parts of the Alps can be very beautiful and very difficult as well. And that mountain time trial, as I said, with the La Turbie, the ascent of La Turbie, and the Col d'Hers as well on Sunday. Lionel, what are your thoughts?
I think it's great. I mean, we should say this is because the Olympic Games will be about to get underway in Paris, and so Paris cannot also host the finish of the Tour de France. And the decision to finish in Nice, I think, is a good and exciting one, especially with a time trial on the final day. That's the first time it will have happened since 1989, which, of course, you know, almost the danger of repeating the final day time trial in the Tour de France is that it won't live up to that incredible showdown between Greg LeMond and Laurent Fignon when LeMond overturned Fignon's 50-second advantage on the final day and won the Tour by 8 seconds, still the closest ever Tour de France. Whether we get that level of drama in Nice next year remains to be seen, but I think the fact that it's different will excite a lot of people. I know it's become quite fashionable for people to complain about the boring processional stage in Paris, but it's a real coup for the Tour de France, because there are very few events that can actually close down the centre of Paris to that extent annually and have that guarantee.
Are you slightly surprised? You said that the Tour de France and the Olympics can't take place at the same time in the same place, but I'm slightly surprised that they haven't tried to mesh them somehow, in the sense that the Tour de France is the most iconic sporting event in France, and I haven't actually checked the dates of the Olympics, but I don't know whether the Olympics will already be underway, will they, when the tour starts? I don't know whether the tour could have, you know, you could imagine the yellow jersey wearer carrying the Olympic torch or something along those lines. I don't know.
I hate to sound like a dad here, always thinking about logistics, but it still means there's 5,000 hotel rooms they need to somehow scrounge very busy.
Surely we could all stay in the Ibis, the various Ibises scattered around the Yvelines.
The Olympics kicks off on the 26th of July next year, 5 days after the Tour de France has finished. I gather from talking to Francois, it is boring practical reasons, as Brian says, it's hotel rooms, but it's also, you know, the strain on the authorities, the police and the various other security services that have to keep the Olympics safe. You know, it's just another job to do in the capital just 5 days before. I think it's just logistically impossible.
I can imagine Pog riding onto the Champs-Élysées, actually waving the Olympic torch like a crazed pyromaniac, and seeing an actual Pog incineration.
Maybe if they went back to
quite spectacular.
Go back to old school rules and just have the tour as a kind of 3 week long time trial, and Pog could ride in. He'd be there a day before everybody else, and it would give the authorities a bit of leeway. But no, I think it's going to be good, that finish down in Nice. A change is as good as a rest. The thing for me is, what does this mean going forward? Does this mean that the tradition is broken and that it makes it easier for the Tour, or more to the point, easier for Paris to say, look, maybe we'll do 3 years in four? I mean, I think there's a little bit of speculation that might be the case. So maybe the long link with Paris and the Champs-Élysées tradition goes back to 1975. Maybe we'll see some different finishes in future years.
Weren't they going to turn that all into a pedestrian area anyways, that part of Paris? So I don't think that the logistics going onwards, looking down the line of years, that I don't think they can actually do that circuit race if they go ahead. And I think those plans have been approved.
Chaps, any ideas? Maybe we've had this discussion before. What other iconic locations could there be in France to finish the Tour de France? It's sort of internationally instantly recognized landmarks that are outside Paris, because, you know, the Giro, I think Italy's, there's maybe less pressure on it because it's not as big a race to find those iconic sites. But Italy has a lot of sort of second tier iconic sites, like the arena in Verona where we finished last year, and I think it's one of the grandest, most beautiful finishes for a Grand Tour. But there are others in Italy as well. In France, it's more difficult. I think the Côte d'Azur itself will be shown off to its best effect by that 2024 Tour de France finish. The helicopter shots will be spectacular. The Promenade des Anglais, there's the cycling link there. But there aren't too many that come to mind. And, you know, somewhere like Carcassonne would make a spectacular finish for the Tour de France. But for a race that's really trying to court a global audience, I don't know. What options might there be?
Marseille, Bordeaux, I think, the Tour de France would possibly go more extreme and say, let's finish on Alpe d'Huez or let's finish on Mont Ventoux. I think that, you know, if there is an opportunity to break with that tradition, Prudhomme is the sort of person that would really break with it and say, okay, we've negotiated to finish in Paris, I don't know, 2 years in three, but every third year we're going to have a really spectacular finale. We'll have to wait and see, but I think it could be, you know, a real change of direction for the Tour.
Looking at what they announced for 24, the dynamics of whatever's going to happen in the race before that, you know, now we see with the Tour this year, it's not the hardest last week of recent years, but the finish next year will be very, very difficult. So I think it'll be interesting to see what's going to be the harder part of the last week when it finishes that hard, because it'll change the racing retrospectively almost. People have to really think carefully about how they spend their energy.
Chaps, we'll be talking mainly about racing in parts 2 and 3, the racing we saw last week, Tirreno, Adriatico and Paris-Nice. But there have been other races taking place over the last few days. In the Women's World Tour, it was the Ronde van Drenthe at the weekend. I also discovered at the weekend that Drenthe is the least populated province in the Netherlands, with attractions including the International Wooden Shoe Museum. Anyway, Lorena Wiebes from the province of Utrecht, not Drenthe, showed the peloton a clean pair of heels to win there and divert some attention away from the Demi Vollering, Lotta Kopecky, SD Works, Sprint Farrago, the previous weekend's at Strade Bianche. Lionel, you discussed this in the pod last week, of course. My two cents, I think it was a bit of a cock-up, to be honest, by SD Works. I was just thinking about always in these situations when two teammates come to a finish together, I always think of when I used to work at MAPE many years ago now, 20 years ago, and how they used, leveraged, and sort of fawned over that image of the three MAPE riders winning Paris-Roubaix or coming over the line together in Paris-Roubaix. And that became the iconic image of the company sponsorship of their engagement in professional cycling. And it was seen to sort of crystallize and encapsulate everything that MAPE was trying to get out of cycling. And SD Works, well, they They didn't get that, did they, with the sprint between Capecchi and Vollering? And I know there were a lot of recriminations. You know, there were things said at the finish. And I was with Hugo Corvitz at Paris-Nice, the Belgian journalist. And his daughter is working as the press officer for SD Work. So she was in the thick of that. So I was getting... I was party privy to some of what was sort of being said and talked about behind the scenes. But, yeah.
Isn't the big difference that in those iconic images that you refer to, Daniel, that Dr. Squinzi, you know, the owner and presidente of MAPE, had already dictated who was to win and et cetera. And
he always denied this.
Then maybe Pasani had in the team car. I don't know. But it seemed like there definitely wasn't an agreement, and there wasn't a set order of who was to cross the finish line first. So what should have been a huge, like, immense success and iconic images for them just turned into a brawl, really, didn't it?
And it was all the more interesting for that, frankly, as we said last week. But I expect Hugo's daughter had her SD Works cut out trying to spin that as a positive for the team. But I mean, yeah, the name of the game is winning first, isn't it? And then sorting out everything else afterwards. So, you know, I mean, I don't think they're going to be too many complaints. They are currently cleaning up across the board, aren't they?
Well, Lionel, talking of women's Strade Bianche repercussions, fiascos, you have news on another one, a more significant one.
Well, we saw Kristen Faulkner of Jayco Alula, who rode extremely well all day, held off Vollering and Capecchi until the streets approaching the Piazza del Campo. And a few listeners actually pointed out, because I didn't notice it on the TV coverage, I must admit, but Kristen Faulkner appeared to be wearing a continuous glucose monitoring sensor on her left arm, and that is not allowed by the UCI regulations. And well, I contacted the UCI and we got a statement back, which I read out in last week's episode, and yesterday they confirmed that Kristen Faulkner has been disqualified from Strade Bianche, where she was third, for breaching Article 1.3.006 bis of the UCI regulations due to the wearing of continuous glucose monitoring sensor throughout the event. Now, these sensors are not allowed in competition, but we know that SD Works, Jumbo Visma, they have official arrangements with our title sponsors, Super Sapiens, to use the technology in training. We know Theo Gegenhardt is a big supporter of the benefits of monitoring glucose during his training, but they're currently not allowed in competition. And even though, you know, you need a phone, or in the case of Super Sapiens, the energy band, to actually see the data in real time, and as far as I can tell, Faulkner didn't have any way of monitoring her glucose levels throughout the event. Nevertheless, it still would have been gathering data, and that is against the rules. And I mean, we haven't heard from either Jayco Alula yet or from Faulkner herself. Maybe there'll be some kind of statement coming over the course of the rest of the week, because they assume will have only have found out shortly before the UCI issued the statement yesterday. But Faulkner was called up late for the race. It could well have just been an oversight. But I do think that this, you know, this will raise the question of whether the UCI need to look again at that regulation. Is there any difference between this and a power meter? I mean, it's a sort of philosophical debate, but also a technical debate. And it's something that Tom Wally and I will probably look at for a future episode of Service Course, because I think it's quite an interesting story and development.
What trend are they ultimately, by having such a rule, it feels like they are worried that this will be a gateway to something else, that there is another metric that can be measured or will be measured at some point in the future, in the near future, that they don't want to be measured?
No, there's a strong anti-technology stance in the UCI that I think is slowly, but as with most things, very slowly changing. You know, it's this one stems back from the days of Hein Verbruggen and Pat McQuaid, that they were very anti-technological. But I think in this case, it's comparing it directly to the power meter, I think is nonsense, because it's two completely different sets of data. But I think the riders and potentially the people who produce this technology, the teams, etc., they sometimes rules need to be revision based on technology advances. Rules don't, so you probably need to revisit them and figure out what the best position is. You can't just rule out anything just for the sake of it.
I just wonder, I mean, more and more people at the moment are talking about lactate testing, and we've seen the images for years and years of riders getting, you know, little pricks in their ears and having their lactate levels measured. I just wonder whether You know, if you were to get, for example, continuous lactate monitors, that or something of that ilk would add another layer to this idea that people have of everything being computerized, quantified, and a little bit robotic. I think a lot of the time that's turned into a red herring, this idea that people are just riding to watts and so on and so forth. But I think that's an impression that the UCI probably want to avoid.
Yeah, I think there's a question of what do the spectators, the sponsors, the riders themselves want the sport to be. Do they want it to be a sport of information, or do they want it to be a sport where athletes are effectively having to go, you know, ride almost blindfolded in a sense? I mean, go on intuition and feel. And I think cycling is such a romantic sport, and we hark back to these kind of romantic stories of heroics where, you know, riders take risks and are rewarded for that. And I think we've seen the style of racing change over recent years, because, you know, these long range attacks that we're seeing that are now winning races from 50 kilometers out, and we didn't see that 10 years ago to anything like the same degree. And I think that is a direct consequence of riders knowing more. They understand more, they have more data, they know, you know, that, so the information that they gather in training and testing is then becomes intuition, you know, so they know what they are capable of. And I suppose it's a question of how far down that road does the sport want to go. And I think it's too easy to say, well, if we give the riders every bit of data on a screen in front of them, that they will just race like robots. I think that's just not practical. The sport is too difficult, too chaotic. There are too many variables, too many decisions. But what it, you know, this particular issue, the glucose monitoring, you know, it might give some riders an advantage. And then it comes down to, when I say an advantage, I mean in terms of being able to interpret that data in real time and know their body better than the next person. And I suppose that's the question of whether we want the sport to be going in that direction. But again, probably something that will be permitted at some point, because I think the tide of progress, you know, is impossible to hold back indefinitely.
Chats, more race news, or at least race program news. We thought Egan Bernal would be back in action at the Settimana Coppi in Bartali next week. This after the organiser of that race sent out a press release crowing about the 2019 Tour champion topping their bill. However, mere hours later, Bernal's team, Ineos Grenadiers, announced that he will now ride the Volta a Catalunya between March 20th and March 26th instead. Geraint Thomas will also start in Catalunya, as will Remco Evenepoel, your favourite Brian. Primoz Roglic and also Adam Yates is going to Catalunya. Final item in the roundup, speaking of Spanish stage races, it was announced a week ago that Burgos Biache and Caja Rural have received the last two wildcards for the Vuelta a España, which starts in Barcelona, where I spent some very frustrating hours on Monday because one runway is closed at the airport and every flight was being delayed about 4 hours. So that was incredibly infuriating.
God, dear me. This is, I mean, Ibis hotels, the Spanish aviation industry. Yes. I mean, anyone else on the Cycling Podcast consumer special?
The Vuelta begins in Barcelona, when all the runways will hopefully be open again on the 26th of August. This means that Kern Pharma and Huescaltel Huescadi will both miss out on the Vuelta a España this year. That is a further body blow for Huescaltel, in particular in the year when the Tour de France will be starting in Bilbao, and they will not be there either. And that, chaps, concludes the roundup for this week.
The Cycling Podcast. Powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thank you very much to our title sponsors, Super Sapiens. Continuous glucose monitoring technology may be banned in the peloton, but you can use it to monitor your glucose levels in real time and gain some insights into how your body processes the food that you eat, responds to the stress of training and racing, and how you recover from those efforts. Super Sapiens has actually joined forces with the NBA, the National Basketball League's Launchpad initiative, which is basically the NBA select a range of tech companies to partner with for a period of time. And Super Sapiens is one of the seven tech companies that are going to be working with them. The NBA offers a range of support and investment and access to their athletes. Quite an interesting development for Super Sapiens, that. And it made me just think that the NBA playoffs are approaching, and my team, the New York Knicks, which I know is akin to, you know, I don't know, an American soccer fan supporting Manchester United, just picking the big city team. But the New York Knicks are famously unsuccessful. They haven't won the championship since the 1970s, but they're my team just because they were the first.
Well,
because when I first went to America and went to New York, I went to see them play at Madison Square Garden. This was years ago now, Patrick Ewing era, late 90s. And
I went to my only ever NBA game was a New York Knicks game at Madison Square Garden against the Dallas Mavericks.
And I was going to ask, Brian, as you've lived in the US, do you have an NBA team that you follow?
Yeah, and it happens to be the most successful one, the Golden State Warriors.
Oh, of course. Well, you were California based, weren't you? Glory.
Well, it's the local team, isn't it? I'm sorry.
The $1,000 bottle of wine NBA team, yeah.
Anyway, Super Sapiens are our title sponsors, and you can find out more about them at supersapiens.com. Just before we move on, a very quick plug for our 1101 Cappuccino, our Substack newsletter, which goes out weekly or thereabouts. This week's one will go out after Simon and I have done our recce ride on the climbs of Milan San Remo. So look out for that. And if you want to sign up and get it directly into your inbox, go to either our Substack page or to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up.
I never participated in parties before, and two times in Torino at the same time, and I always feel that I'm good at the first races, and it was always my goal to, my dream to win parties as well, and now that I did it, it's incredible.
Well, chaps, that was the very familiar voice, now very familiar voice, of Tadej Pogacar, the winner of Paris-Nice at the weekend. I guess you were both watching. Well, I hope you were both watching. I was there. Pogacar winning the general classification by 53 seconds over David Gaudu. More significantly, perhaps, Brian, certainly as far as Danes were concerned, he beat Jonas Vingegaard by 1 minute 39 seconds. Just run down quickly some of the stage winners, in particular from Paris-Nice. Tim Merlier won a stage match. Pedersen, Jumbo-Visma won the team time trial. Then, well, Pog won stage 4, he won stage 7, and he won stage 8. And stage 5 was won by Olaf Koy. Stage 6 was cancelled. As I say, I was there. I was on my, I was busy with my other gig with ITV, and well, it delivered, didn't it, chaps? We were looking forward to the duel between Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogacar. It was a pretty emphatic verdict in favour of Pogacar, certainly after, well, he dropped, surprisingly, really. I don't know if you were watching live the stage to La Loge des Gardes. That was the first mountaintop finish in the middle of the week on the Wednesday. And, well, we saw what looked like a pretty scintillating attack from Vingegaard, and Pogacar seemingly only able to follow. But then when Pogacar countered, Vingegaard sort of blew up, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I mean, it opened, I think, the speculations, if not just isolated from this stage, but in general, where they compare, obviously right now, but where will they compare in peak form in July? That's, I mean, we all want to see that duel, but I think it's a question of how do you measure them up against each other. It was clear last week in Paris-Nice, but what does that mean for the tour? That's the big question for Jonas Vingegaard, and that's been, you know, him being Dane, there's been so much discussion and speculation about that in Denmark, and it sort of divides people into saying, well, he shouldn't be that good now, it's all about July, and others, probably including me, saying, well, why, you know, he won in Galicia, the Gran Camino, he said he came to Paris-Nice to win, he knew that Pogacar was going to be there, so he must have also had an idea of where he was in terms of his shape. But I think we already saw in the team time trial that it wasn't exactly shining hour for him.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was about to say. I think the first warning sign was the team time trial. Jumbo-Visma came with a team that was stacked for the team time trial. It looked as though they were investing a lot of their hopes in that particular race with guys like Affini. They had Rowan Dennis there, but they were pretty, it was pretty threadbare team as far as the climbing department was concerned. They had Dennis and Tobias Foss, but it was a team of time trialists. And okay, they took, I think it was 23 seconds on Pogacar, but we saw this sort of scintillating last kilometer, which, well, we'll talk in a minute about the format of the team time trial with everyone, each of the riders getting their individual time effectively. But this scintillating last kilometer where he was sort of catapulted, launched by, was it Mikael Bjerg, wasn't it, the last rider for UAE? And that really limited his losses on the team time trial. And then, well, that was a foretaste of what we saw in the remaining stages. Particularly, you know, it again, Pranis again demonstrated this incredible explosive flourish that Pogacar has, that we've seen many times. But it's such a weapon, particularly, and this is another sort of innovation with Paris-Nice that maybe we should talk about, is we had these intermediate sprints which were worth 6 seconds, which made them very valuable indeed. They weren't just a sort of a mid-stage diversion which ultimately decided who was going to win the green jersey. They became very much worth going for on the general classification, particularly when they were almost a fait accompli for Tadej Pogacar, because I don't know, I mean, watching him sprint, it occurs to me that the guy could be finishing in the top 10 in bunch sprints. He's so explosive. Every time he sprinted in Paris-Nice, he wasn't just beating the likes of, okay, David Gourdou, you know, these are climbers, but fast climbers. He wasn't just beating them, he was dropping them in the space of 100
Michael Matthews,
meters or so.
He beat Michael Matthews early in the week.
Slightly contentiously, leading some to suggest that the friendship, the Michael Matthews, Tadej Pogacar friendship, was a bit more like an agreement between teammates. But, you know, that was a real feature of the race. And you will talk in a minute about Roglic as well, how it's been a cornerstone of his success over the last few years in his fast finishing. And I don't know, this is a headache for Vingegaard looking ahead to the Tour de France.
One thing that people keep saying in his defense, which I don't think is a valid argument, at least not this year, is that but let Pogacar burn all these matches using all his energy for these seconds and for these fast finishes, because he's going to pay a bill in the third week of the tour. But then when you look at the other two tours he's raced, when you look at the Vuelta he did in 19 in his debut year, and when you also add what the tour looks like in the third week this year, I don't think it's a valid argument saying that, oh, he's just going to waste all his energy, so he's going to crack in the last week. I don't think we have enough data to really prove that.
True, but if you look back at last year, we were at this point, Pogacar had won the UAE Tour. He'd absolutely destroyed everyone at Strade Bianche, and he'd won Tirreno Adriatico, not quite in such a dominant form, but he was looking very good. And then, of course, you know, the really eye-catching result of his spring was when he was in the mix at the Tour of Flanders. The difference this year is that Vingegaard is in the spotlight in a way that he just wasn't last year. And so there is a temptation to look at Vingegaard this week and think, oh dear, he is well off the back here. And I know it's only seconds here and there, but if you extrapolate a Paris-Nice over 3 weeks and throw in the severity of that final week, you know, a minute over a week, you know, becomes three or four. There is a catch-up to do, but there's time to do it. And I do think that Pogacar, not saying he paid the price for having such a strong spring last year when he got to the Tour de France, but it's a long season, long way to go. I just think it's interesting signs. And our friend Francois Thomas, when I asked him, you know, after Pogacar and Vingegaard gone for the bonus sprints on the opening stage, it was notable that Vingegaard sent his teammate the next day, and Pogacar still sort of snaffling up points, Eddie Merckx style, time bonuses, Eddie Merckx style. I said to Francois, you know, what does this mean for July? And he just said, well, not a lot at this stage. And I think that's true. Vingegaard has got some stuff to think about, but there's time to think about it. And let's also realise, you know, the team has got the time to put more resources behind him for the mountain stages as well. As you said, Daniel, it was a little bit light on the climbs, and we kind of saw not a full strength Tour de France style Jumbo-Visma team. So early indications, but by no means does this mean that July's done and dusted.
on the time bonuses as well, I said that in a race like Paris-Nice, you know, they have usually been thought of as a bit of a mid-stage diversion. That's not the case in the Tour de France, where the green jersey, the much darker green jersey as of this year, which I think has caused some teeth gnashing, that is much more prestigious at the Tour de France. And you will have guys like Wout van Aert sprinting for intermediate sprints, and it'll be much harder for Tadej Pogacar to pick up that sort of cheap time. The other sort of note of caution I would say with Pogacar is what have been his weaknesses in, well, certainly last year, this idea, and I think it's been confirmed by him, that he's not as strong in the heat. It was maybe notable that after Saturday's stage, finishing on the Col la Cuyol, which he did win, he also mentioned the heat, and that was the one day he didn't managed to emphatically drop and David Gaudu. And when I say heat, it was about 20 degrees, if that, on the Col la Cuyol on Saturday. The other thing is this issue of the longer climbs, which we didn't have at Paris-Nice. We know that, well, I think he talked on Sunday about how he loved Sunday's Nice-Nice route, partly because the climbs were sort of 6-7 kilometers, and that is absolutely perfect for Tadej Pogacar. I mean, if he ever does go back to the Vuelta a España, I think he will blitz that race, because there are a lot of much shorter climbs there. In the Tour de France, we're going to see a lot of 12-15 kilometer climbs, and it's all going to be very different. But, you know, he hasn't been to altitude yet. He, I think, surprised himself with how strong he was. He sounded very confident in his interviews. He is sort of, well, he's kind of growing in stature, I feel, in his team, in the peloton. He is no longer the kind of shy, slightly bashful anti-star that he was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. He's someone who seems very much in control of his craft at the moment. And he's 24. There is a good chance, of course, that he's still getting better, still developing. And that's also slightly worrying for Jonas Vingegaard. But
there's ways also to, I mean, those, if you say he has an Achilles heel with the heat, There's a lot of research going into that at the moment, and yes, it's not like the UAE is lacking budget to figure out, you know, the avant-garde of the science on the subject. So I think there's a lot, there's so much they can do as well. You mentioned that Vingegaard has work to do, but I'm sure that UAE, if we all know that he has those weaknesses, I'm sure they know them inside out as well, and need to figure out a way to manage them.
What's also going to be fascinating is just their respective build-ups to the Tour. Well, they're probably not going to race again until the Tour de France. They're not due to race again
together.
Pogacar's got a packed spring program, most of the classics, both Ardennes and Cobble classics, and then we're not going to see him again until the Tour of Slovenia. And at this stage, Brian, I mean, we've seen with Roglic that Jumbo-Visma are open to tweaking riders' race program. Roglic wasn't supposed to do Tirreno, he did do it in the end. But Vingegaard's not supposed to race again until the Dauphiné.
Racing in the Tour of Basque Country, actually.
Oh, that's been added. You're right, that has been added. I think that was a change of plan, was it?
No, not to my knowledge, actually.
Okay.
It's still a rather meager. I mean, it's respectively 14 and 16 days of racing before they see each other at the Tour. So it's a very different, because you can't compare Pogacar doing 7 one-day races from now until Liège. The concentration of racing for Vingegaard is completely different, because he's doing that week of in the Basque Country, and that's it until the Dauphiné. So it is very different, but it suits their style of riding a lot. You know, Vingegaard definitely is going to the Basque Country to seek confirmation and to try and win, which will be a whole lot easier with Pogacar not being there and Roglic probably neither. I'm very curious to see what level he'll perform in the Basque Country. We all know that Pogacar is going to pick up one or two wins over the next period, even if they are the biggest one-day races in the world.
Not the ideal week for Vingegaard, but a good week for the Danes, Brian, because Mads Pedersen won a stage and had a day in the yellow jersey, and then Magnus Cort.
Mads Pedersen did actually exit the race with illness, which wasn't the perfect lead-up to a race like San Remo, a race that he does not like either at all, but suits all his qualities. So, yeah, I mean, you can't really have a week of racing in the main part of the season where it's not a success for the Danes these years, Lionel, to be honest. And I'm not flying the national flag, so yeah.
Very true, very true. But Magnus Cort took the jersey in that team time trial. The first time, Daniel, we've seen that format. What did you make of it being there on the ground? Because on TV, it was quite tricky to sort of see any trends. Well, it was kind of going into the unknown. We didn't, you know, this idea that teams would maybe slingshot a leader to ride maybe the last kilometer, to see if they could eke out a few seconds. The format would suit a kind of team time trial with an uphill finish absolutely brilliantly. We might see a really spectacular stage unfold, but it was quite an interesting test of the water, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if this came across on TV, but it was actually an uphill finish, not a steep one, not a long one. It was probably, I think it was only 500 metres uphill, but that did alter things. And I'm not sure you would have seen Pogacar launch in the way he did if it had been completely flat. So I think it was kind of a perfect finish to trial this new format. If it had been a harder climb, then every team probably would have ended up doing the same thing, whereas this opened it to different scenarios. You saw Jumbo-Visma finish with, I think it was three riders together. So I think it was fresh, it was novel, it was, as I said, I think I wrote on Twitter, that it gave these sort of snapshots, these images, which kind of encapsulated, well, how I certainly think of Pogacar versus Vingegaard. Vingegaard is part of, he's a unit within this incredible collective force that is Jumbo-Visma at the moment. They're the dominant team in professional cycling, and they all came over the line together, whereas Pogacar, he's the sun and the moon and everything else for one particular team, UAE, and he finished the time trial with this swashbuckling solo effort, which is very much in keeping with the way he rides. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. I think that we'll definitely see it again. I don't know what you chaps thought.
Well, I thought it was, we always see in the races like Paris-Nice and the Dauphiné, something that will crop up in the Tour de France in future years, whether that's a climb or, in this case, a format. Clearly, they will use it in the Tour de France at some point. And I think with some clever routing, you know, sometimes the team time trials are about damage limitation rather than seeking an opportunity. And I think this would spin it round in a big race like the Tour de France, where absolutely everything matters. You could see the whole range of things, especially if they had a much more of a proper uphill finish. Doesn't need to be necessarily too long, a couple of kilometres maybe, but that could really make for a spectacular, you know, appointment with the TV day of the Tour de France, and you would see the whole lot. You might see a team where the leader is struggling and they've got to all rally around. You might see a team where the leader is flying and goes off and really makes some gains. And I think it would make that balance much more about the individual within the team rather than the team being about the you know, the strength of the fifth man or the fourth man.
I mean, you know, it did do, speaking to people in the teams, the mechanics and so forth. I mean, one of the beauties of the team time trial when you're on the ground is the sense of this latent like tension and anxiety in the teams. Everyone, it's the most nervous day of the year, particularly when it's in a grand tour for everyone. That wasn't present because, well, as the mechanics told me, or what people working for teams telling me, you know, there wasn't that much riding on the performance of guy 4, 5, 6 in the team. So for them, it was a much less of an anxious day than ordinarily would have been the case. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't really know. But that was quite notable.
I think it changes the dynamics and it makes it, for me at least, a lot more interesting. And I'm not even sure that we need a finishing climb for it to be that. The strategy of each team needs to be considered and will show itself quite visibly for the spectators. And I think also if it will be introduced in this era that we're in now in the Tour de France, it's going to be extremely exciting when you look at the various candidates, you know, going into the next, I want no decade or next 4 or 5 years. So I think it's going to be, I think it's here to stay. And I think it's going to be, it's also depending on how long it is and where it is in the race, I think it's going to have an influence on who people will eventually select to go to the Tour de France. So, and I think that's also, that means it's very significant just because of that.
I think it's good as well in that it's a visual representation of what a team is actually there for, particularly in stage races. Because I think this is something, I've said this before, I've said that I think all time trials should be team time trials, but particularly so with this format. To a layperson, it's quite difficult to explain what is the role of a team, why it's important for a leader to have teammates around him. But essentially their role is to launch him in a figurative or literal sense. In this case, they were launching the leader almost literally. And it, as I say, it was a clear visual demonstration of that.
It's the best point, Daniel. It's really a condensation of what teams are there for in those big appointments.
That tension that you talk about is really apparent when you're at a team time trial at the Tour de France. There's just an energy around the paddock, and just no one wants to really get out of their bubble before a team time trial. And you can almost feel the opposite of that at the end when it's all over. But that doesn't really translate into television pictures. You don't really see that tension on the screen. Whereas with this format, you could really see some tactical innovation. You'd really see much more clearly who's going well, who's struggling. And I think the results could be significant, but not perhaps as, you know, decisive and damaging as a bad team time trial for a GC contender can sometimes be, which sort of leaves you with that deflated feeling that a GC rider's been let down by his team or by circumstances after a team time trial.
And very final point, just on that tension, and Pogacar, I said this sort of easy breezy air about him that Pogacar has. He seems almost immune, completely impervious to any tension. I mean, the Colnago time trial bikes arrives a few days before the team time trial, and in any other team this would have been the source of great anxiety. Didn't seem to bother him at all. He did his recon on the Friday, I think, before, so it happened on the Tuesday, the team time trial. Didn't even go for a recon. I think they were the only team UAE that didn't recon the course on the day, so in the race conditions, didn't seem to cause him any anxiety whatsoever. Chaps, a couple of hot takes from Paris-Nice. David Gourdou, genuine Tour de France contender or not? Genuine friend of Arnaud Démare now or not? That was the big talking point at the start of the week, how he and Démare were going to mesh together, whether they were going to bury the hatchet. And we saw Démare leading him out at intermediate sprints, obstructing Tadej Pogacar. All smiles, all slaps on the back at the end of the week in Nice.
Brian shaking his head there. I mean, he did ride extremely well to get in there in the mix with Pogacar and Vingegaard. And it will be, you know, give the French a great deal of hope. But I mean, I think it shows some progression from last year, significantly so. But I was looking at his result in last year's Tour, fourth, of course, you know, on paper, you know, that looks like an excellent result. But 13 minutes 39 down. And when you look at recent editions of the Tour de France, that's generally only good enough for sort of, well, seventh or eighth at best, but normally just at 10th, 11th, 12th. So, you know, the classification tells some of the story, but perhaps not all of the story. And I think that this week for Gourdou suggests that he has closed that gap and was able to not just match accelerations, but mix it properly. I thought it was a really smart and impressive ride. And of everybody, he was the only one to really put up much of a fight in the face of the Pog slot.
It is as well, chaps, the opportunity of a lifetime for Gourdou, I think, in the sense that the race will start in the Basque Country with some Tour of the Basque Country style stages. There is none of, I think, if you think of a normal Tour de France, the two things that would cause someone like David Gourdou most anxiety would be a first week of a lot of flat stages with a lot of fighting for position, sprints, the risk of crashes, and then long time trials. In this Tour de France, we're going to have first 3 days, which, as I say, is akin to a mini Tour of the Basque Country. And then we've got one time trial, and it's a mountain time trial. So I think it's a perfect opportunity for him to, I don't think he's going to win the Tour, but I think he, and I also think Enric Mas have got a good chance of not pushing Pogacar and Vingegaard close, but certainly finishing third.
I agree. I mean, when you look at the parcours, like you mentioned, he will need to use a lot of energy initially to try and actually gain time on some of those other rivals for the third place, in my opinion. I don't think he is, I wouldn't consider him for the overall win. And then also, if we follow the conclusions that we talked about earlier about Paris-Nice, that if Vingegaard is in the shape he was last year, I think once it really kicks off in the higher mountains in the middle part of the Tour, I don't see Gourdou being at that level as those two guys. And there's a reason, even if he's progressed, there's a reason why he lost all that time last year.
Last couple of things on Paris-Nice before we move on, chaps. Brian, just give us a quick synopsis of what was being said in Denmark about Vingegaard and the Vingegaard, I'm not going to say failure, but maybe people being sort of nonplussed by the outcome of the result of this duel with Pog.
I think the majority of people, and I'm not sure if it's wishful thinking more than it's analytics, they see it as a sign that let Pogacar do all these things, let him ride all the classics, let him take all those risks that those races involve. And then Vingegaard will beat him in the Tour like he did last year, because he's gonna be fatigued once we get to the pointy end of those 3 weeks. I don't agree with that analysis, but I can see why it's helpful if you really see Vingegaard as being on top of things. And I don't think he was on top of things. And I had a few discussions with people because I said, well, he said he was going to win, so he must have had some kind of assessment of where he was in terms of his shape. But then if you then use the excuse afterwards, well, I don't need to be in my top shape now, then why would you even entertain any ambitions? You know, when you saw how they rode for the team time trial, when you saw how they protected him and even put tempo in some of the climbing stages, they must have thought that he was in contention more than just, you know, trying to like be there and see what was going on. He was trying to win the race, but he came out short. So I think it's a cause for serious concern, but that's all projection also at my end. But mostly people were quite happy with what they saw. It's the best result he's done in Paris-Nice as the best result any Dane's ever done. You know, he's going to have a stronger team in the Tour. And people have this idea that Pogacar will just somehow break under his own weight because he uses all this energy.
Final thing, completely trivial, but again, the cause of some debate on social media. The green jersey, the dark green jersey. Yes or no, Brian's making Italian hand signals, not a fan. Just on this, it's also going to be, I believe, unless the reaction is so sort of forthright against this new dark green jersey, it is going to be the same colour for the Tour de France. I also asked Bora whether they were going to change their jersey for the Tour de France, because it's pretty much a Bora green. I haven't had an answer on that yet, but I think there's a good chance of that.
I like it. I mean, the green jersey has changed shades over the years. In the very late 80s, 89, I think it was a real kind of bright, almost lime green when Sean Kelly won it for the fourth time. Yeah, 89 was the year when Mario Schifano, the Italian pop artist, designed the Tour's leaders' jerseys. So the green jersey has changed shades, and I think it's, you know, the whole point is that it's to, you know, attract a bit of attention, isn't it? I quite like it as a change. And I think it taps into the current kind of, you know, jersey design, doesn't it? It's the sort of thing that you could see a weekend warrior really rocking.
Well, the yellow jersey has changed its tonality based on the textile and the evolution of fabrics over the years. So, yeah, I don't really see it as a big deal.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, our long-term supporters. Now, I've been teasing over the last few weeks Science in Sport's Strava Challenge, which is to celebrate the arrival of the Spring Classics, and it kicks off on Saturday, the 18th of March, and runs until March the 31st, and the challenge is to ride 100 kilometres. Already, almost 50,000 participants have signed up on the Science in Sport Strava Cycle Club, and everyone who takes part will get a 20% discount at scienceinsport.com, and one lucky winner will get the prize of a lifetime, the chance to be in the velodrome at the finish of Paris-Roubaix. See the Strava Challenge for all eligibility and terms and conditions. I'll put a link to that in our show notes. And just before we move on, just a mention for MAP as well, our clothing partners. The Cycling Podcast jersey is back in stock at map.cc. And to mark their Pursuit of Progression campaign, we have been asking for listeners to send in their what they want to do on the bike in 2023. I read out one last week and another entry in Explore. And David Pond says he's got two aims for this season. The first is to ride the Gent-Wevelgem Cycliste Sportive and take in the Ploeg Streets, which are the gravelly roads not far from Ypres. And then at the in the height of summer, he wants to ride the Dunwich Dynamo, which is a 120-mile overnight ride from Hackney in northeast London to Dunwich on the coast in, I think, Suffolk. And he's aiming to arrive for sunrise. That's also a ride I'd love to do, but it always falls in July, so I've never been able to do it. But good luck with those two rides, David. We'll be in touch to send you a pair of MAP Cycling Podcast socks.
You had to drink a lot of champagne this week, all those jerseys, three-stage wins, and the general classification. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it's better to drink with some kind of reason. it's just a great week behind us. I just said, I mean, on the podium, then at the end, yeah, it's only me, but should be the whole team, everyone. I mean, the guys really worked every day hard and good. So, yeah, at the end, we could achieve what we did all together. So, yeah, pleased to be part of it. And, yeah, it was really nice and I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, chaps, that was another Slovenian voice, Primož Roglič, winner of Tirreno Adriatico for the second time in his career. He wrapped that race up after three stage wins like Pog in Paris-Nice, three in a row for Roglič. The other stage winners in Tirreno, Ganna, Jakobsen, Philipsen, and then Philipsen again. On the final day, on the GC, Roglič, well, thanks to, again, largely time bonuses, he was able to beat João Almeida by 18 seconds and Theo Gegenhardt. Theo Gegenhardt, who's on a fantastic start to the season, by 23 seconds. Chaps, Roglič, write him off at your peril. I put a tweet up the other day about his extraordinary record in stage races, stretching back to 2018. Since Tirreno 2018, he's worn the leader's jersey in every stage race he's competed in, apart from three Tours de France. This was sort of mocked, scorned by a couple of people. They said, well, if he didn't wear them in the Tour de France, then the 21 other stage races that he's led don't really matter. But I think this is an era-defining run of results in stage races. Quite extraordinary.
He deserves a lot more. He deserves a lot more credit. I'm sure that it's reflected on his salary. But I think that because we tend to talk so much, especially this year after the Tour last year, we talk so much about Vingegaard and Pogacar. We talk a lot about Evenepoel. I think defining Roglic's career by his shortcomings due to crashes and other things in the Tour, I think that's unrespectful. He's an extraordinary rider. And he's a wonderful rider to watch racing also, because he wins the way he does. He's a great time trialist, but he wasn't really in Tirreno. He came up quite short on the first individual time trial here, just around the corner for Ramsitting. So I think he's such a great addition to those races. He might have his shortcomings in the Tour, based on the competition, and he obviously won't ride it. But I still see him as a very realistic contender for the Giro, even if Evenepoel is gunning for it full gas.
It made me think as well, Charles, the fact that we had Pogacar winning Paris-Nice and Roglic winning Tirreno. I mean, these two guys now have really defined the last three or four years of stage racing. And this brought up again the question of how we feel about domination. Domination of one rider, or in this case two riders, one nation. With Pogacar in particular, I saw some people suggesting that he could have spared us the spectacle of him riding everyone off his wheel, and some even said humiliating the opposition at Paris-Nice on Sunday. I don't know. I mean, I think we've had this discussion before. Lionel's making sort of barking noises.
The wolf of Macon is stepping in to say, I mean, we have this both ways round, don't we? I mean, it might not be the same people, but, there will be a reaction regardless of the way the races pan out, won't there? When a rider does too much and wins too much, they get criticised. I mean, I just think about, Roglic. Remember when he, got pelters for chasing down Gino Maeder at the 2021 Paris-Nice? And, I think we saw in that race in the space of a week, because, of course, he had that terrible day on the last day. And going back to Brian, I do think the thing that is attractive about Roglic is that he has this capability to completely implode, sometimes completely out of the blue. And you can understand why he would not want to, let up and give any gifts. I think with Pogacar as well, there's a slight difference there in that he seems to love the racing. He's racing for sprints because it's there. He's racing for, in the team time trial, riding the way he wants to ride. He completely dominated all of the uphill in Paris-Nice. And I think they are very different characters, but you can see across both of them why, when a rider has a chance to, turn the screw, they will do so. And Roglic, yes, he won three stages in a row, but his winning margin was pretty slim, only 18 seconds. Pogacar, I mean, it was all there for him. Just sitting on somebody's wheel and just cruising up and letting somebody else win the stage, it's just not in their DNA. It's not what the sport is about. It's a bit like saying Tiger Woods in his pomp. Well, you're seven shots ahead, just par in from here. No, he's going to try for a birdie or an eagle on every hole. I mean, that is, we want this essence of sport. Then the question is, when does that domination become, you know, too much, too boring, and people then start to root for the underdog? In my case, I kind of always instinctively root for an underdog just because I think they throw up the more interesting stories. I do find domination, you know, boring after a point. But it's not Pogacar's fault. It's not Roglic's fault. They're there to try and win as much as they can.
But I think you don't ask an athlete to ride against their nature. And then against some, in my opinion, misconstrued aesthetic or moral ideal that goes counter to what professional sports is about. And I think also, I mean, come on. I mean, you, when you think of what these, even, you know, the greatest talent in modern day, in my opinion, Pogacar, they still sacrifice a lot to actually get to the point where they can be that strong. It's not just something they do off the tip of their head. There's also a way to respect that the work that their teammates do. You know, they don't work all day for you to like hand out presents to your competitors at the end. There's maybe not so much in Paris. I mean, I'm sure they're all well paid. There's prize money at stake. There's all kinds of things at stake that I think it just goes against what we're looking for in professional sports.
But it's also a society on wheels, isn't it? And the peloton will decide. You know, if Pogacar, if there's a sense that he's sort of rubbing people's faces in it, there will come a point where the peloton will sense that there's a weakness, and if there's ever a show of weakness, they will gang up to, you know, exploit that weakness and turn the tables on him. That's how it works. And I suppose that is what, you know, if you're looking at the ideal narrative of the cycling season, I almost want Pogacar to kind of build himself up into this absolutely unbeatable force and then see him unpicked at the Tour de France, because that would be the most entertaining story, I suppose.
Yeah, on that idea of the society on wheels, I mean, there was the only hint I've seen of that, and actually I don't think anyone found out exactly what was going on, but apparently on Sunday there was a moment where David de la Cruz had been in a break, the Astana rider, former teammate of Pogacar, he'd been in a break and he was chased down by UAE, and they sort of were making hand gestures at each other. So David de la Cruz was indignant that UAE had been riding on the front and, well, riding the way they were to try and set Tadej Pogacar. But that's the only hint of it. And this is one of the interesting things about Pogacar, that he does seem to be very well liked by almost everyone in the peloton, completely unanimously. And Lionel, you said you always root for the underdog. Things, there are elements of the underdog. You can find elements of the underdog in almost anyone. And we all bring our unconscious biases to this idea of who we like and who we root for. With Pogacar, I mean, I'm possibly unconsciously drawn to the fact, and also with Roglic, that they're from this very small Central European country that people don't really know much about, and that in itself makes them feel a little bit like the underdog. Roglic, obviously, we all know about his past as a ski jumper. There's something unlikely about that. There's this idea of adversity that's accompanied him throughout his career, and going back to Pogacar, I mean, he's the ultimate showman. What he did on Sunday, he didn't have to do, but it was in the name of offering, well, enjoyment for himself and stimulation for himself. And he's talked about, you know, that was one reason he wanted to do Paris-Nice. He's wanting to do different things all the time. He's, everything he does is to sort of combat the ennui, the monotony of his own sort of life and career and domination, if you want. But he offered a fantastic show in that final stage. I mean, there was talk I heard from someone in his team on the final day that his original idea on Sunday was to attack from kilometer zero. He felt so sort of confident about that stage because there were these sort of home roads, and so excited about the idea of racing on those roads that he had an idea to launch an even more spectacular attack than the one we'd seen. That didn't materialize in the end.
There's always 6-day racing if people want to see something else, you know.
Or cycling course. Just on Pogacar, Roglic, the two kings of Slovenia in Paris-Nice, I did have a chat with one of our colleagues who works for Slovenian National Television, RTV, that is, of Slovenia. His name is David Chermil, and he's pretty much the only Slovenian journalist who's been following these two boots on the ground at races for the last few years. So David is in an ideal place to tell us sort of how they're thought of in Slovenia, how their relationship or how this sort of rivalry, a very friendly rivalry, has evolved over the last few years. So let's hear from David Chawayon, the two stars of last week and of the last few years, certainly of stage racing, Tadej Pogacar and Primož Roglič. Okay, David, well, you're a familiar face now, bike races, or you have become one for the last 4 or 5 years now. So when you first came, we used to talk, you were the oddity, you were this strange creature that come from this strange country. Wow, there's a Slovenian at the races. Now it's very common because Slovenia has been dominating professional cycling in some sense for a while. So Pogacar, it looks as though he's going to win this race. And his star just continues to rise. His personality seems to be getting bigger and developing as well. But I want to ask you about the Roglic-Pogacar sort of dichotomy. For a long time, it seemed as though Roglic was the national treasure. He was the one that everyone loved. Pogacar, everyone admired. Is that changing a little bit?
Okay, yeah, I think it's changing, but still... Roglic was the one that started all of this. Okay, there were riders before, like Hautmann, like Božić and Brajkovic, Valjavec and so on. But Roglic started this, you know, when we were saying how nice it would be to have a Slovenian with stage victory in Tour de France. And it was Primož that started this. So it's logical that people liked him, even after. And also... it's his story that is so different, and he's not a cyclist, he's everything else. He started with 22 years old and so on with cycling, so the story and everything behind. He comes from ski jumping, which is, I can say, national sport in Slovenia. This is something that people admire. Then you have Tadej, who is born cyclist. He really, I don't know, he makes it look so easy. Maybe that's why Primož is more admirable in Slovenia, because for him, for Primož, it looks very tough, everything. Yeah, that's true. Even though he wins, and he wins a lot, and by a big margin, let's say, when he sprints uphill. So, but with today, you could see it yesterday, it really seemed so easy, so... I don't know, maybe that's why, because I don't know, maybe Slovenians like to see people suffer, I don't know why, but I think still in Slovenia it is a bit more of a star, Primož. Maybe still, maybe after a while when we will find out and see what they achieved would be different, because this is something that I don't think we managed to understand what they achieved.
One thing that happens or has happened in the past, when a rider from a country without a big tradition in bike racing starts to win, for example, the Tour de France, the media arrive en masse. Lots of journalists, TV stations, and the pressure increases, and it starts to become quite suffocating for that rider. I mean, I even saw it with Vingegaard last year when he won the Tour, and you know what the Danish press and the Danish media are like. There was a lot of attention. It's always surprised me with the Slovenians that it's been you and pretty much no one else for the last 2 or 3 years. And it always strikes me that this is this works in their favour, Pogacar and Roglic, because it seems to be a limited amount of scrutiny, attention, spotlight. And also it never seems to become a pressurized and a negative force.
Yeah, it's interesting, huh? We can say that I was, for the first time on the Tour de France, I was in 2012 when Jani Brajkovic was ninth. So I think that before Primož, our riders were available, you know what, over the phone calls and so on, and if you don't have the rights, okay, we have it for the Tour de France, then you need video, let's say. And we were at the Tour. But others, you know, it was like, okay, a phone call away. So no one really came here. I really don't remember who came here before, let's say, me. And it's now more than 10 years ago. Yeah. And
but where are the Slovenian newspapers? Where's the big? What's the biggest newspaper in Slovenia?
Okay, the biggest is Delo.
Where are they?
They last year, I think their journalist that covers cycling was here for, let's say, 2-3 days maybe in Alps. Then when Primož was fourth at the Tour, I know that another journalist from Delo came for 2 days, three okay. days at the finish. I don't know where they are. No, the journalists from the, what can I say, competitive television, he comes often at the Tour de France for a few days a right. year. But I'm happy we're more or less the only one. That's how riders know you. They, I hope they know you better and they are more available, let's say. But yeah. I also like it because then, you know, you mentioned before, when you're done, I come in mind, it is my turn and I'm alone. Yeah. So it's yeah. really nice to be Slovenian at the moment at the Tour de France or even these races.
And you work for state television or national television. Just tell me, during the tour in the summer itself, how sprawling is the coverage now? How many hours a day does it take up and has that increased a lot?
About the hours per day of the race itself, it's not more, because I think it's about the rides, and we can cover the tour from 3 o'clock in the mm-hmm. afternoon and until the end. So I think we even did it a bit more a few years ago already, but yeah, we grew. Let's say, I think in 2012 or maybe, I don't know, we started the Tour de France, covering the Tour de France all the stages. Before it wasn't like this. Okay, in 2012 we came here for the first time. Then we did the show before, let's say, before the tour. Mm. Now, last year or the year before already, we've had it for the first time every day after the stage, like half an hour of a show.
Studio show.
Let's say it like okay. this, yeah. A studio show with live, let's say, with live stand-ups from here, okay. with me and the other team. So okay.
It's not like the Danes. When I go for my morning run, when I go for my morning run on the Tour de France, I go at 7 in the morning and I'll find 3 Danish crews, one reporting from the bridge, one reporting from the castle, one reporting from outside Vingegaard's hotel.
I've heard there were 24, I think, last year from the television. I'm not sure. Mm. Don't get me wrong. Maybe I'm lying. But no, it's not like this. It's like we are here at the tour, let's say. Yeah. We are in two journalists, two cameramen, and then from radio, two guys maybe, from national television and radio. So this is more or less, we didn't have any studio here yet, and also the commentators are at home. It's okay, at least I'm proud that the success, you know, of first Primož and then Tadej didn't surprise us, you know, because we grew with Tour de France, let's say. We added, every year we added something, you know, something more. And then when they came, we were practically ready. We only added another team here and a bit more of a studio and so on. So this is what I'm proud of, that we really were growing, and I hope we'll still grow as much as those riders. It's amazing.
And last thing, David, I have to ask you, everyone is already talking about the tour because Vingegaard's here, Pogacar's here. First blood yesterday to Pogacar in the head-to-head battle. Do you think he'll win this year? Do you think Tadej will win the tour this year?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, we have to be optimistic. I'm Slovenian, so yeah, of course. But I hope it will be a tough battle, close, not like a few minutes of difference. So I think he wants to win it again. If not, he wouldn't return. He would pick up a Giro or something. But
so Primož wins the Giro, Tadej the Tour, and then Domen Novak the Vuelta.
Maybe they split at the Vuelta. Who will win it? No, can you imagine? And it, I'm sorry, but it really is possible. And maybe one or two classics at the same time. No. A few years ago, we were talking about winning a Tour de France stage. Even before, being in a breakaway would be something. And it's not that far away. Now I can't even imagine. Still.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Well, Daniel Bryan, what do you think of when you think of Milan Sanremo?
I mean, there's an overall feeling which tells me that it's springtime in Italy, and it sort of opens the gate to the next month and a half of incredible racing. There's a special atmosphere to all of those. But I also have personal, very fond memories, you know, when I worked with Cancellara and when he won it, but definitely also the year Simon Gerrans won it, beating Cancellara amongst others. And yeah, there's just the, from the start in Milano and then to being on the Ligurian coast, it's just magical. You almost feel that transition from winter to spring on your own body, from the cold and often damp and cloudy part of Milano to the beautiful sunshine in San Remo. So I have many fond memories of it, and I was actually considering taking the train up on Saturday, not to Milano but to San Remo, just to get a whiff of that atmosphere once again.
Thinking about the times I've covered the race, just the sense, I mean, particularly in the early 2000s, just the chaos of the finish line, which I don't think it's quite as chaotic as it used to be, but there were various editions that finished just in complete pandemonium. I mean, there was one in 1993, I think, where I wasn't there. That was long before I started covering cycling. But when Fondries won and Mario Cipollini threw his bike through the rear windscreen of Carmine Castellano, the race director. But it was quite easy, even in sort of 2000, I think 2002 was the first one that I did, the one that Cipollini won. It was very easy to see how that had happened, because I mean the Italians love what they call a casino, which is not a place where you gamble. There is a famous one of those in Milan Sanremo. Casino is just a mess, chaos, and there was no more chaotic finish than Milan Sanremo. People being separated from their bikes, people being almost crushed, it almost being quite dangerous at times. And then, you know, the fastest sprint that I personally would do in the season would be the sprint to try and catch riders as they rode through the finish line and down towards what's the old train station in San Remo, which is a good couple of kilometers past the finish in Via Roma, and always losing riders because there are also quite a few hotels on that stretch of the Via Aurelia, the coast road beyond the finish line, and some riders sort of disappear into hotels because teams tend to, I don't know whether anyone actually stays in those hotels, but they still...
It's for showering.
Yeah, they have showers in these hotels beyond the finish line. So, you know, you'd be looking for Robbie McEwen, and you'd be looking for, I don't know, Alessandro Petacchi for half an hour after the finish, and then someone would tell you that they're actually, you know, they're disappeared into that hotel. And it was actually quite a frustrating race to cover from that point of view, because it was over so quickly. I mean, I always say that the image I always have in my head of the race coming towards you in Milan San Remo is of this kind of huge wave, like a tidal wave, cresting over the Poggio and then crashing down into San Remo, and then it's all over very quickly. And as a journalist, you're usually sort of scrambling, floundering around looking for scraps, and it's quite difficult. But as far as the race is concerned, yeah, it's the most electrifying last half an hour of a race of the season. And, you know, still people, we get this debate every year, what's your favorite monument, what's the most boring monument? People always say San Remo is the most boring. It's my favorite monument, just looking ahead to Saturday and just thinking about how people can upset the odds, because the odds suggest that the race should finish, well, I was about to say it should finish in a sprint. Actually, that's less and less the case, and in fact I don't consider it sprinter's classic at all anymore. However, for any single individual, maybe with the exception of Wout van Aert, to win, they would somehow have to upset the odds. And that even applies for Tadej Pogacar. It even applies to him, I would say. And that's, to me, one of the most interesting talking points about Saturday's race and Milan-San Remo. I asked Pogacar at the start of Paris-Nice, did he have a plan already in mind of how he could win it? And he said he's got a few scenarios. Obviously, didn't reveal what they are. He and lots of other riders who live in Monaco, who live on that coast, will have been to San Remo and they will have enacted those particular scenarios in training. I mean, Matej Mohoric, when he won last year, he said afterwards that he'd spent a whole day, one particular day, where he thought he'd done the Poggio climb and descent about 12 times. And he literally rehearsed exactly the move he made on the descent to win Milan-San Remo. But how Pogacar is going to win, particularly thinking about last year and his team, UAE, setting a blistering place on the Cipressa, and they sort of had everyone reeling after that ascent of the Cipressa, which seemed to have set things up perfectly. Pogacar, he then attacked incredibly early on the Poggio, almost at the start of the Poggio. He attacked them multiple times and still wasn't able to break the elastic. And what he did, I mean, I said everyone was reeling. Everyone was sort of staggering around the ring. And then it was Mohoric that landed the knockout punch. I mean, what's your guys' best guess as to what this plan is that Pogacar has in mind, particularly thinking of how he failed last year or how it didn't work out last year?
They want to try the same thing again. They want, I mean, maybe Lionel can have a look at it, but just let me finish. Lionel can have a look at it when he does this, the Friends of the Podcast special with the wind direction on the Cipressa and potentially also on the Poggio. But they will need, or any other one rider with the same strategy of making the race hard, could be even Wout van Aert for that matter, they just need to make it as hard as possible from the Cipressa, if not earlier. And then they'll have to see what the outcome is. And anyone wanting to win the race, if you look back on previous editions, even going back to when Nibali did his attack, which was a bit of a scramble, and then he ended up having an advantage anyways, they'll need to be in the first 10 coming into the, or first 15 coming into the Poggio. So that strategy doesn't change, in my opinion. How else would he win the race if he doesn't try and make it hard earlier?
I mean, I've looked at the wind direction for when Simon and I are riding it, which is cross-tail. I've no interest in what the wind direction is for the pro race at the moment. I mean, it could change around, but cross-tail wind certainly on Thursday and Friday, so we'll see. I mean, I should stress I'm not taking 2 days to ride from Savona to San Remo. It's only 100 kilometers. But
on that, actually, I don't remember any edition of Milan San Remo where I didn't get a phone call, because I would usually be one of the first people in San Remo on the team. I would get a phone call immediately, or I was told to send a message like, "What's it? Tell me exactly the wind direction from when you come out on the Aurelia after the Turchino and on the coastal road." Because it is one of, you know, in a race that's so condensed and so easy before it gets difficult, all those things are being taken into consideration, both for the teams trying to get in the breakaway and staying away as far as possible, and for people actually wanting to set up a win.
Lionel, can Pog win? How could he win? My theory is that, you know, I always talk about this in San Remo, that the only way you win is by exploiting a moment of hesitation. That is incredibly difficult to do when you're the race leader and the race favorite, or one of the two or three race favorites, and every move is going to be marked, every move is going to be, it's going to be noticed. I think he somehow needs to convince the rest of the peloton that he's not on a good day, that he's not really in the race until his one decisive move on the Poggio. That's going to be difficult. I think he needs to hide somehow.
Needs to hide and exploit the fact that maybe people will be thinking the same about Wout van Aert and Matthew van der Poel, who, I mean, van der Poel actually looked good in moments in Tirreno Adriatico. He did that incredible lead out for Philipsen, didn't he? Van Aert, of course, crashed on stage 4, crashed into Tom Pidcock, or brought Tom Pidcock down, or I don't want to apportion blame here, but they both lost a big portion of their shorts. Van Aert looks a little bit like a rider who's trying to force himself into form, which is not ideal going into Milan-San Remo. I mean, we say it every year, don't we? But the race offers this fantastic balance between the kind of the punchers, the even GC-type riders, versus the sprinters. I know it's not a sprinters classic, but if it all comes back down together, you know, fast finishing can win the day. But then also there's the sort of Filippo Ganna type who could take a do a Cancellara and take a flyer. I mean, we saw Jasper Stuyven did that a few years ago. So there's so many ways to win a race that when it's all said and done, you look at it and think, oh, well, it was obvious that was how it's going to turn out because of how the Cipressa and the Poggio went. But that's the joy of it. I mean, I think, Daniel, your quote last year or the year before, it's as relevant now, but Milan-San Remo is a race that you need to kind of watch with binoculars or a telescope, because those tiny little
microscope.
Moves. A microscope even, yeah. Those tiny little moves that, you know, we unpick in retrospect. You know, Caleb Ewan showing too much on the Poggio when perhaps he should have just sat in the wheels and just waited. And that's the thing, isn't it? As you say, Brian, the easiest race to get into a winning position, but then probably one of the most difficult to turn a good position into a winning result. And that's the bit that we all want to watch.
And it can be a matter of just seconds, even for the strongest riders in the world. I was looking a little bit closer at when Nibali won, which I think was a fantastic addition. You know, he had 11 seconds coming into the descent on the Poggio. He had 8 at the bottom of the descent of the Poggio, and he had 5 seconds in the last kilometer. And it was just a question of a few hundred meters between him, you know, winning an iconic race and just being left with nothing. So it's just these tiny little fractions of seconds, which is the biggest contrast to it being the longest race.
Yeah, I mean, Mohoric in his drop a seat post last year was, you know, clearly showed the level of thought that had gone into it, as you say, Daniel, with the repeated, you know, learning those roads. But then in race conditions, it's slightly different. I always think it does favour a rider that no one's really watching or no one's really thinking they have to react immediately.
Yeah, but still, they would need to have shown themselves at some point in Paranese Tirreno to be strong enough to actually finish the job.
Okay, I'll give you a name. Søren Krau Andersen. As not, and Lionel's shaking his head, Lionel's countryman. He was climbing incredibly well on the last day of Paris-Nice. There were a few Danish journalists, obviously, there were quite a number of Danish journalists at Paris-Nice, and one of them was interviewing him on the final day. They said he'd not won a race for 900 days, or I think it was the 900th day since he'd last won a race. And he's been very much out of the spotlight, moved teams in the closed season. He's also, the Danish journalists have told me, very cagey. It's very difficult to find out from Søren Krau Andersen how he's going and what exactly is going on. But seems to be riding well, has been very prominent in the finale of Milan-San Remo the last 2 years. He was probably the reason Jasper Stuyven won in 2021. And last year, he was right on Pog's wheel when Pog tried to attack on the Poggio. Brian, why were you shaking your head a minute ago? Why is he not the dark horse?
I'm not saying there's a curse of the Krau Andersen. I think he will eventually win a big bike race again. I just think there's people who will be lining up to be stronger than him on Saturday. But one thing that actually supports your theory, Daniel, is that he's emotionally attached to certain races where he's had a good go, where he's felt good. He's a rider that relies heavily on being confident, and then somehow sometimes he loses touch with his self-confidence. But he has a lot of self-confidence regarding San Remo, so I think that will support him, especially now that he's finally at a good level again as a racer, and there's a good chance he'll be there. I just think there are riders who are more likely to beat him, and he might fly under the radar in certain contexts, but if he's sitting with as one of the first 10 guys on the Poggio, people will know that he's there.
It strikes me, just thinking about Mohoric and what he did last year and this idea of hesitation and telegraphing moves, Mohoric's tactic, someone doing an incredible breakneck descent, is probably the only kind of undefendable move you can make at Milan-San Remo. That's the only... You know, something like that, maybe Mohoric doing it again, I think is the only thing that could scupper absolutely everyone's tactics or everyone's...
The quick question is, that can Milan-San Remo be won by a rider who doesn't live in Monaco?
Yeah, I mean, Mohoric last year, he went around the peloton in the first 6 hours joking to friends, asking friends whether they knew whether San Remo had a good hospital. because he envisaged taking rather extreme risks on the descent, which is what he did in the end. Yeah, that's a good point, Brian. And I think this is something we maybe discussed before, that we were going to come up with a definitive list of Milan-San Remo winners who have lived in Monaco, and it's just a lengthy list, a very lengthy list.
I do think the problem is that 3 days out, it's like a game of pin the tail on the donkey. I mean, you could stick your tail on and get it bang on, or you could get it someone, you know, on the nose, or the one of the hooves.
Arnaud Delis has donkeys. He owns donkeys, doesn't he?
Indeed. I think that there's a few names to conjure with. I think Biniam Gamay looked good in Tirreno Adriatico. I mean,
do you think that?
Well, I thought he looked all right. Yeah, I mean,
been a bit undercooked.
Didn't/couldn't react, you know, at a key moment, but then got back in. You know, I don't know. I think that there's always intrigue and interest around teams that have got one of each card to play, you know, a puncher and a sprinter. And really, you know, there is a few. I mean, Mohoric has got the added advantage. I'm not saying that Pasqualon is going to win, but he's a decent finisher if he can sit in there. And I think with your Crow Anderson suggestion, Daniel, the fact that he's on the same team as Van der Poel and Jasper Philipsen, again, can Philipsen get over them, and be in position into the Via Roma? Not sure. He seems to be a sort of Sam Bennett type sprinter. And then Jumbo-Visma, you know, Van Aert, big question marks about him. But what about Christophe Laporte? Ridden it, I think, 8 times. Best ever finished 71st. But the way he was riding at Omloop and Kerner, Brussels Kerner, and in, you know, with a more important role in the team, who knows?
Mads Pedersen, Magnus Cort. You know, you mentioned Søren Kragh. I think there are better Danish candidates. Magnus Cort usually does really well. He can definitely climb and without losing too much of his explosiveness, and so can Mads Pedersen. He did exit Paris-Nice with illness though, so there's a minor question mark next to him as well.
Well, we could go on all day, couldn't we? We could name
all 180 starters.
My actual official tip for Milan-San Remo, of course, I made it a couple of months ago, and that was Arnaud Delis, although I came away from Paris-Nice slightly less confident. If I'm confident, the only thing I'm confident, relatively confident about as regards Paris-Nice, is that Jan Tratnik will be the first rider. He will lead onto the Poggio, because I think he was last year for Bahrain Victorious. He's now moved.
Have you found a bookmaker that will give you a good odds?
I don't know. That sounds like the kind of thing I should contact a sort of a Malaysian betting syndicate of dubious repute, and they would probably offer odds on that.
So Tratnik leads onto the Poggio. Well, we'll find out on Saturday, and we'll discuss all of this, won't we, Daniel, in Arrive, which will be out on Saturday night.
Yes, and I think that just about concludes the speculation and the entertainment.
Indeed.
Does it, Lionel?
It does. I'm just going to get my trumpet out because my podcast series...
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Tour de Corse that Simon and I made, riding around the football grounds of Scotland, produced brilliantly by Tom Wally. It's been shortlisted for the Sports Podcast Awards, and you can vote. You have to register and log in and stuff to register a vote. I'll put the link in the show notes. A little bit of a faff to vote, but would be very grateful if anyone who enjoyed that series would vote for us so we have a chance of winning.
Well done, Lionel.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait, and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.